Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Avery Russell, who's an assistant professor of biology here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Avery.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Avery, describe yourself as a biologist. What kind of a biologist do you consider yourself to be?
I'm a behavioral ecologist, which means I'm interested in how learning and memory or the cognition of organisms drives the ecology and evolution of their partners.
And so you and I talked a little bit about plant-animal-microbe interactions. It sounds pretty complicated, the three partners in this whole thing. So give sort of your stand-in for the most common one that you study.
Right. So I work a lot on pollination ecology. So I'm interested in how bees in particular drive the evolution and ecology of plants, in particular the flowers, and the microbes that live on those bees and live on the flowers.
And so we talked about bees. To me, I think bees and I think honeybees. But of course, I got disabused quite quickly after speaking with you to recognize now that honeybees are just a tiny tip of the iceberg. So talk about that whole bee-ness in the United States a little bit.
Sure. Wonderful. And first, even though I want to go into the United States, I want to talk even more broadly because
okay,
that just
enough.
Gives an
fair
idea
enough.
Of the diversity. So we got about 20 to 22,000 bee species in the entire world. About six of those, I believe, are honeybee species. Of them, the European honeybee, which we're most commonly acquainted with in the U.S., is one of those species. It is, in fact, an invasive species in the U.S. We brought it over as colonizers. And, of course, most of our bee species are native, and we have about 4,000 native bee species in the U.S.
And so are all the bees participating in the sorts of things that people typically think bees do, or do they do different things? So these other bees, they don't make honey, or what exactly do they do?
Right. So a couple of those bee species do make honey, but the majority of them do not make what we would consider honey. So many of them make what's called bee bread, where they mix a combination of pollen and nectar together into a loaf, which then the larvae of the bees can eat and then grow into an adult.
And so they're important still. So talk about their importance to what we consider the important things in life, which are us. All these bees are contributing to the environmental health of... Talk about that. How do they do that?
Sure thing. So many bee species range on a continuum from being specialized on their plants to being very generalized on their plants. So when you think about a honeybee, they're visiting potentially dozens of different plant species. And when you think about bumblebees, which are a very large component of the natural ecosystem here in the Ozarks, we have about 35 species of bumblebees in the U.S. and a couple species in Missouri. And those species are extreme generalists. They visit dozens or hundreds of plant species. But many of our native bee species are specialists on maybe just a single species or on a couple species across a few different genera or families of plants. And what that means is that they can only pollinate and they only prefer to pollinate a few of those plants to get their resources, their nectar and their pollen.
And so all of them are pollinating. And of course, talk a little bit about pollination as an industry. It's very important to the ag business and to our lives in general. So explain sort of what that dynamic looks like.
Certainly. So I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, unfortunately, but bee species are very, very important. It's been estimated that one of every three bites that you eat is probably pollinated by a bee or a pollinator of some sort. If you think about huge industries like the almond industry or the tomato or the blueberry or cranberry industry, those are all insect-pollinated plants, and bees are in particular one of the chief pollinators of those plants. So the tomatoes are grown primarily in greenhouses down in northern Mexico and Arizona and California. And in order to pollinate those, we have to ship tremendous numbers of bumblebee colonies, which are commercially reared, to those greenhouses to pollinate indoors. And in fact, bumblebees and a couple other native species are some of the only species that can pollinate those tomatoes. Honeybees can't do that, for instance. So if you think about blueberries and cranberries, also, honeybees cannot do a great job pollinating those plants.
So let's talk about what the U.S. or North America looked like at one time. So honeybees, the European honeybee, which is what we usually associate with bees, only brought over in the 15th century or something like that. So before that, humans were here for something like 20,000 years-ish before that or something like that, maybe. And so there's a lot of bees around, and they're still pollinating things. Is that right? All the pollination is still going on to the native plants in North America,
presumably? That's right. Yeah, those 4,000 species or so, those are all pollinating those native plants. They're doing a tremendously good job. They have co-evolved with those plants. And so their behavior and the plant's morphology and functions are co-adapted to each other. And of course, the bees and plants are not in this hunky-dory, happy state. This is what we call reciprocal exploitation, where the bees are trying to consume more of the pollen and nectar than would benefit the plant to provide, and the plants are presumably trying to get more pollination, if you want to consider it that way, out of the bees than would benefit the bees to provide.
So before we get into the microbes specifically, let's talk a little bit more about the bees and the plants. So most people think about plants, and evolutionary processes affect plants, and they say to themselves there's pressures brought to bear for survival, essentially, and so different characteristics can come to the fore over a long period of time. But when they think about humans, for example, humans breed things and we short circuit the entire process and make it quite short. Now, bees have some level of cognition. And so talk about what you know about learning in bees. I mean, can the bees essentially drive the development of a plant intentionally, sort of, or how does that work?
Right. So there are a bunch of different questions there that are really great. So let me go to the intentionality argument. So I would argue none of this is intentional. It's just the organism doing what it's doing. So bees are incredible learners. They're capable of learning visual, olfactory, electrostatic, tactile cues, iridescent cues, polarization cues. And those are just the senses that we know about so far. And so they're capable of learning all these things in relation to rewards presented by flowers in service for pollination. And so all those different types of cues can be readily learned by those bees, usually on the order of a couple trials. So when we think about humans, if you or I are taking an exam, we might have to take dozens of attempts before we learn the material. But a bee is capable of learning most of those things on just a couple trials. So they're very, very quick learners, and that's because they have we presume that they have evolved to be quick learners because they have short lives. They have to learn these things really, really rapidly in order to feed their nest mates, or if they're solitary, which most bee species are, they have to feed their larvae, and they have a very short window in order to do that.
So their cognition is learning cognition, but not so much as some sort of well-thought-out strategy. They learn things that are useful for them to survive, but they still can drive how plants respond. So what kind of timescales might we talk about here?
Right. You could imagine short timescales as well as long timescales. So on the short term, you can imagine if you are learning a task really rapidly, you can change the distribution of traits in that plant population based on how quickly you're learning. For instance, let's say you learn a preference for purple, and so you really prefer purple flowers now. So now all the white flowers out there are getting less visitation than the purple flowers. So now in the next generation, those white flowering plants have produced less seeds because they've been less pollinated than the purple flowers. So you can immediately change the reproductive landscape of the flowers and drive the ecology of those plants just in a single generation, based on the ability of the bee to learn that trait.
Okay. So it's quite complicated. Now let's bring the microbes into it. So what exactly the role that they play? And usually we think of microbes and we think of how they affect animal populations, but they're important to the plants also. So now you got plants and animals and microbes. So what role do the microbes play?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially because right now in a human world, we're thinking about how microbes affect disease ecology, but we're also thinking about probiotics and how microbes can benefit our ecology.
We have a lot of bacteria in our gut.
That's right, yes. And bees do as well. They actually have a resident gut microbiome, which is composed of yeast and bacteria, and that is presumed to help them digest material. In fact, if you look at the work of Dr. Nancy Moran, you'll see that her work really shows how those microbes affect animal behavior as well as animal fitness or bee fitness. So those microbes are commonly found on bees and on flowers. And so I specialize on the microbes that are found on the surfaces of these organisms and are dispersed by bees from flower to flower. And those microbes could affect the scent of the flower. So microbes produce a lot of scents. As you know, if you take off your shoes after a long day, your feet are kind of stinky. Those are the microbes. And so bees have feet, of course, and they're moving those microbes around too. So you might have lots of stinky microbes moving around from flower to flower. And the bees can presumably sense those microbes. And also those microbes could produce pigments, and so they could change the color of the flower in ways that the bees could detect. And that could change the preference of the bees, either through those visual cues or through those olfactory cues.
Now, you think about the deleterious effects of microbes. We have all these microbes living on our gut. We have all microbes living on the surface of our skin. And most of the time, they don't bother us too much. And you got to figure that the microbes must play a beneficial role. But then are you worried about the negative role that the microbes play? And how often is it negative, or how likely is it to be negative? I mean, we hear a lot about the bees and all the diseases they seem to be getting now. So is it really likely that the microbes are good for the plants and the animals to have in the case of the bees and so forth? Or is it pretty negative?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a really open field right now. So I just want to point out that most of the microbes that we are associated with are beneficial to us or neutral in some way. We have trillions of microbes living in us and on us, and those microbes do a whole variety of functions that we have just barely begun to scratch the surface of. Many of them are involved in helping us digest things. And that's the same way with the bees. We know some degree what these microbes do, but we have very little knowledge about the broad spectrum of the microbes. And what we know mostly is that you often get systems that when they go out of whack, then you will get disease being caused. And so we have been interested in a bit in how that occurs too. So we're trying to understand whether, for instance, certain microbes act as probiotics for plants and either increase attraction to pollinators or increase the learnability of those flowers or protect the flower from other microbes. And we're also interested in how those worse microbes, the microbes that are not beneficial for the plant, get out of whack and start causing disease. And sometimes it's just a consequence of abundance, that microbes that are in low quantities are okay, and then when they increase to a large quantity, they start to cause deleterious effects.
Okay. So now, take us out into your experimental process. Field work, lab work, combination of the both. So if you wanted to start one of your studies, what would you go do?
Right. So I'm mostly a lab rat, and so I'm interested in bee cognition. And there's an excellent model system for working in the lab with bees, and those are the bumblebees. We can get those from commercial suppliers and rear those in the lab and give them flowers that we've grown in a greenhouse. But in order to inform all of our studies, what I like to do is combine a mixture of field and lab-based work. So I'll go out into the lab with colleagues, and we'll collect microbes from those flowers, grow them in the lab, examine what those are, and see their effects on bee cognition, learning, and memory, and on flower reproduction. And we'll also collect plants in the field and bring those back in the lab and study how we can maybe examine their evolution of their floral traits in response to bee cognition.
So let me ask you this. How many interactions do you have here? So most people would think, oh, I'm worried about this one microbe. So I'll study this microbe and I'll study how the bee and the plant react. But you say there's a bunch of microbes. And so how can you tease out how all of them tie together? I mean, it's like a mini body interaction. You have 10 different things affecting 10 different things. How hard is that to tease out?
Very difficult. Yeah, and so we have done a pretty paltry job of doing this so far. Currently, we're examining one bee species, our bumblebees, common eastern bumblebee, Bombus impatiens, which you see over most of the East Coast and now sort of drifting into the Midwest more and more. And I usually work on a couple different plant species because I want to show that there's a general truth to what we're examining, that the patterns that we examine with this one bumblebee then spread out to many different plant species. And so to do that, I use both artificial flowers that I can make in the lab using my third grade arts and crafts materials with my students, and then also using live flowers of a bunch of different species. The microbes are much more difficult to work with. So we don't have a lot of knowledge about what types of microbes are found on flowers. So usually what that means is that first we have to collect those microbes, and we don't know what they are because we can't ask them and we can't tell what they are until we grow them and sequence them. And then once we do that, usually we like to make artificial communities of microbes, just a couple of bacteria and a couple of yeast. That way we can control for effects that the community interactions might have on the ecology of the system. So those bacteria and yeast are interacting with each other and also the flower and the bees. And so the more complicated we make the system, the harder it is to understand it.
So when you think about that, you think about people working out in the field for a long time, studying things like bees for a long time. So where would you consider the field to be? Because you said it's still sort of early. I mean, these interactions are not well understood, at least at the level of all the various variations, so to speak. Is that true? I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done then?
Absolutely, yeah. So the idea of microbes affecting bee-plant interactions has been around for about 100 years, but only in the last 20 years or so has there been a large enough body of work that we can start to examine broader questions and start to test these things in an experimental fashion. So most of the work that's currently been done has been on yeast-nectar interactions. So nectar is, of course, a highly carbohydrate, highly sugar-rich substance that bees need to consume to survive. But it's also a really microbial-rich environment, and a lot of yeast will grow in nectar. So folks have been asking, especially Dr. Rachel Vanette, Dr. Ted Fukami, have been asking questions about how the nectar microbes affect the nectar quality and affect how bees will then interact with the flower. Now, I'm interested more in a broader microbiome, which is to say the microbes that are living on the surfaces of the bees and on the surfaces of the flowers, not just in nectar. Not all flowers have nectar, for instance.
Right.
And microbes might be living on different parts of the flower based on the chemistry and environment of those different parts.
So now you're here at Missouri State. You're getting ready to start up on your academic career after a postdoc. So students are going to be involved. Talk about what students will do. What sorts of things will they do and learn in the process of this kind of a project?
Right. So I have three major aims of my research. One is about how the behavior, cognition, learning, and memory of a bee drives its success, its fitness, and how that drives the evolution of flowers. And so some students presumably will be interested in the more psychology questions of how bees learn, what are they capable of learning, and what constraints of learning there are on these bees. So what types of cues can they learn or not? And then there's the microbiology plant interaction component, where we want to understand what consequences microbes have for plant fitness, how they affect bee cognition, and how microbial traits affect their dispersal from flower to flower and from bee to bee. And then the last larger aim, which is done through a number of collaborations, is to understand how to zoom out and understand the evolutionary history of plant-pollinator interactions. So we're trying to understand how bee behavior evolves, In particular, one question we've been asking is how this particular behavior called floral sonication or buzz pollination has evolved. It's a specialized behavior that about 60% of bee species are capable of using to extract the pollen from flowers. You might have heard these high-pitched buzzes on your tomato flowers, on your blueberry or cranberry flowers, and that's the bee using buzz pollination to remove the pollen. And so we're trying to understand how that behavior has evolved, the evolutionary pressures that have led to that behavior, and also how the flower has evolved in response. Many of these flowers have these tube-like anthers, the male part of the flower, where the pollen is concealed in that flower, and the only way to remove that pollen is to buzz it out. And about 8% of flowers, or 25,000 species of flowers, have this type of morphology, and we're trying to understand how the evolution of the bees has driven the evolution of the flowers and vice versa.
Interesting. So then describe your collaborators. Your collaborators are what? Evolutionary biologists plus blah, 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 blah. So
right.
Tell me all the people you collaborate
with. Oh, man, that's a lot of people.
The names, but yep. The kinds.
Sure, yes, absolutely. So we have a microbiologist that are working with us. I'm hoping to bring on some physiologists. That way we can understand the energetic demands of some of these behaviors. Working with behavioral ecologists. And working with evolutionary biologists. So at a few of the institutions, we have folks at University of Arizona, in Stirling, in the UK. We have folks at University of Pittsburgh, in Ottawa, all over the place. So we're hopefully an international collaboration amongst a lot of like-minded scientists that are trying to build connections between a bunch of different fields that have not often enjoyed these connections.
That was great. Well, Avery, I really appreciate you stopping by. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed that pun.
And once again, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.